For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB. I'm your host, Red Sale, and once again, producer Hannah has stepped in for injured Robert. Get well soon, Robert. We're missing you. Coming up in this week's show, Booker shortlisted author Martha Mengistu takes us back to 1935. And introduces us to the African women who fought Mussolini's invasion of Ethiopia. MJ Ford introduces us to his dark new crime thriller, Watch Over You. And Brandon Taylor reveals how his Booker shortlisted debut, Real Life, had to be saved from the trash. That's all coming up in today's Read On. But first, with the Booker Prize due to be awarded on the 17th of November, it's time to meet the last two shortlisted authors. First up,
Martha Mengistu's Booker shortlisted novel, The Shadow King, is set in 1935 during Mussolini's invasion of Ethiopia and shines a light on the African women soldiers who fought in the conflict. Theirs is a story largely forgotten by history, as Martha told me when she joined me from her home in New York. Martha Mengistu, welcome to Read On.
Oh, wonderful to be here. Thank you for the invitation.
For those who haven't yet picked up The Shadow King, could you give us a brief synopsis?
Yes, The Shadow King is set in 1935. It opens during Mussolini's invasion of Ethiopia in an attempt to colonize it. It tells the story from both sides of the battle lines, the Ethiopian and the Italian. And I feature the women who were fighting alongside the men in the Ethiopian army, a little known fact that I discovered.
I believe there is actually some family history behind this discovery as well.
There is, Red. You know, I found out almost at the point when I was getting ready to submit the final draft of my novel, that my great-grandmother had also enlisted in the war. I had no idea about this while I was writing the book. I thought that I had to be careful with my research and accuracy and make sure I wasn't making anything up. And then the story was also in my family.
There are two very strong female characters within the book. Hyrat, who is an orphaned girl who has been sent to work as a maid of all things in the compound owned by Kidana, and his wife, Asta, who is quite a feisty woman.
Yes, I wanted to tell this story from various perspectives of the female experience. I wanted to tell the story on the Ethiopian side from the soldiers, the male soldiers as well. And Hirut is an orphan. She's working as a maid for this noble family. And they treat her the way that most people would have treated their servants back then, as really inconsequential and an afterthought. She was somebody that they could order around and do what they wanted with. But Hirut feels like she's more than what people imagine her to be. And this war gives her an opportunity to step forward and gain a level of independence as a soldier. And Aster, too, you mentioned her. Aster is a formidable character, someone that is complicated, and people either really like her or they just learn to appreciate her strength, because eventually that works in the favor of the war. But she's complicated and has lived through her own experiences of people telling her that she has to follow rules because she's a woman.
And the book begins with skirmishes between Hirut and Asta. And it is actually only when the invasion begins that they begin to fight together. And Asta refuses to stay at home and do the wifely thing. She puts on a tunic and goes into battle following her husband.
Yes. And she too thinks, I'm more than what my husband thinks of me. I am more than what people have said just because I am a woman. And she really thinks that she is just as capable of fighting as the men. And she sees this war as an opportunity to change the course of her life. War creates chaos. And in that chaos, she can create her own destiny and her own fate, completely separate from her husband as much as possible. It's interesting to look at Aster and Hirut through the lens of war, because these are two women whom, by social standards, should never have really communicated with each other the way they do. Aster was born rich and Hirut was born poor. And when you are born that way in Ethiopia in 1935 in a feudal society, that's the position you stay in. Rich and poor don't speak to each other as equals. And yet here is a world that suddenly turned into chaos because of fascism. And they realized that regardless of their social standing, as two women, as human beings, they have to stick together and fight against fascism. That is the common enemy. And that's what happened during the war.
The traditional order has been overthrown, as is evidenced by the fact that the king, Haile Selassie, has fled to England. We see him in interludes throughout the book, trying to make sense of what's going on by listening to the opera Aida and reciting the lineage of the powerful families within Ethiopia.
Yes, he can't quite grasp the upheaval that has come. He seems stunned by it, almost to paralysis, and keeps looking at the opera Aida as a clue into the Italian mind. I should say Verdi wrote Aida, and the Italian people had come to love it because it told them something about Ethiopians and Ethiopian girls and women. And he wanted to figure out what that was as a possible clue into the Italian psyche and a clue into how he might be able to defeat these Italians. Haile Selassie left the war and moved to England, to Bath, and watched the war unfold at a distance. And this is something that the fighters never quite forgave him for. And I've always wondered what that must have been like for him to have been so far and to know that on some level, people really were demoralized and did not respect that move.
And in many ways, whilst this book is a standalone book, it is also a companion piece to your first novel, Beneath the Lion's Gaze, which deals with Selassie's overthrow in the 1974 revolution in Ethiopia.
Yes, thank you for asking that. Not many people catch that. The first book is set in 1974, and the second book begins in 1974 during a revolution to overthrow Haile Selassie. Then my second book flashes back to 1935, and that's where we stay until the very end. We go back to 74. And I was very interested in the continuance of memory, of history, of war across decades. You know, we are often given these very neat and compact dates for when wars ended. World War II ended on this day. World War I ended on this day. We have that, but we don't talk about how war ends for those soldiers who were fighting, how war ends or when it ends for those people who were taking care of the wounded or having to bury the dead. When did war end for them, despite the declaration of the end of a particular conflict? And I wanted to explore through Hirut, who opens the book in 1974, what human beings carry with them of memory and trauma, the scars that are on the body that might signify psychological markings that conflict or confrontations leave. But you are absolutely right in saying that these two books sit next to each other, because I really think that 1935 led to the 1974 revolution.
You also point out that the first Italian attempt to invade Ethiopia in the 1890s haunts the 1935 conflict. Some of the participants on both sides have been deeply scarred and wish to avenge themselves for the loss of fathers or uncles in that first conflict. And it also informs why the Italian commander is as brutal as he is.
Yes, and that was a historically accurate representation. When Mussolini was getting ready to invade Ethiopia, galvanizing public support, one of the things that he kept bringing up was the defeat by Ethiopians 40 years prior. He kept saying, we will avenge this. We will avenge our forefathers. We will avenge the blood that was spilled. It was a humiliation for Italy, and he was determined to establish and cement his rule in Italy by winning Ethiopia in 1935. What he said was that they would get Ethiopia at all cost, with or without Ethiopians. So they were ready to annihilate everyone, women, children, the elderly, including the soldiers. And that was their strategy. But on the side of the Ethiopians, there were the stories of heroism and defiance from 40 years ago that galvanized the country. When Italy came back in 1935, that generation that was going to fight said, our fathers fought this and now they're back again. We can do this. They had no idea about the level of advanced military they would be facing. Haile Selassie was aware, but these were farmers. These were poor people. They didn't know what they would really be confronting, but they were ready. But, you know, again, Red, one of the things that I keep coming back to with war is the way that confrontations scar us as human beings, the way that we carry those things. And with Kidane, his father was a hero from the Battle of Adwa. And one thing that Kidane says is that the thing that was wrong with his father, who came back home from that war 40 years ago, a changed and scarred man psychologically, he said the thing was that his father outlived his destiny. He should have died in battle, but he came back alive. And what came back was something different than what left. It's that idea of war that I'm really interested in exploring. Like, what comes back? And how do families and loved ones begin to grapple with the consequences of various confrontations?
Is that where the voice of the chorus that is present in the book was born for you? The chorus is angry, wants to express pain and rage and its scars.
That's an excellent question. And it is. And the fact that you say that the chorus is angry is absolutely spot on. That was what I wanted to convey. These are the voices of a collective, perhaps alive, perhaps dead. And they're a presence in the book. They want the truths to be known. And there are multiple and contradictory truths to war, to history, to memory. And the chorus is there to say, Aster might want you to remember this way, but that's not actually how it happened. I had a lot of fun with the chorus, partly because they're angry, and that's a fun character to write. And the chorus was influenced by my love of the Greek tragedies. Agamemnon is a play that I go back to repeatedly. And the chorus is the chorus of old men. Agamemnon has been gone for 10 years. Clytemnestra has been wreaking havoc in the palace. They're tired. They don't want to argue with her anymore. She's strong-willed. And they had a personality. They talked to each other, talked back to each other, talked to Cassandra in different ways. I said, I want to create a chorus with a personality, not something staid and remote, but something that actually engaged with the text. And it was a blast to do.
It adds a wonderful dimension to a very complex narrative structure. You also tell the story through photographs that Hayrat has unearthed of the conflict, and from the point of view of a young Italian soldier whose own birthright is catching up with him when he finds out that he has to register as being of Jewish descent. And as you say, it proves that no one person in a conflict has all the story at their fingertips.
You're absolutely right. There's a question that I have been asking from my first book into the second one, and it is, how is it that decent people end up doing indecent things? How is it that someone who was raised as a good person, as an upstanding member of society, does something that seemingly goes against their code of ethics? And Ettore was somebody that I wanted to explore this with. He's a photographer, and he's soon being ordered by Colonel Fucelli to photograph the atrocities committed on Ethiopians who were captured during the war. And he finds himself in this very precarious situation of being an artist. He sometimes cannot help the fact that he wants to photograph the prisoners in beautiful ways. He's aware of lighting, silhouettes. He's trying to get the right angle, and he co-opts his own talent in the service of violence. And yet he's Jewish, and he's subjugating a group of people because of their ethnicity, because they are Ethiopian, African. And yet soon the anti-Semitic laws pass in Italy, and he's subjugated to the same kinds of discriminations that he was participating in against Ethiopians. And I know that those cases existed. I know that that's a part of the story of Italy. And I wondered what that does to somebody to be an Italian one day and then a non-Italian the next day, because you can't call yourself Aryan the way that the Italians were starting to call themselves, because you're Jewish. He was a complicated and interesting character for me to follow throughout the course of the novel.
And his duality, I felt, was also picked up in the character of the Shadow King, who we must mention, who is Hyrat's brilliant solution to who the troops should rally behind when Emperor Haile Selassie has done a bunk to England. And she chooses the lowest of the low and dresses him in emperor's robes.
Yes, his name is Menem. He is a musician. He is a farmer. He is poor. His name in Amharic means nothing. And here's this man that had this uncanny resemblance to Haile Selassie, and Hirut masterminds this ploy to inspire and lift morale amongst the fighters. It's interesting to think about leadership, about what makes a leader, what makes a ruler. And if a man who says that he can trace his blood back 3,000 years to the Solomonic era, and that justifies his rule as a monarch in Ethiopia, Haile Selassie, if he could be replaced so easily by a poor farmer who has absolutely nothing to his name, what makes a leader? And how sturdy is the foundation on which so many of our leaders stand?
Now, the book has been brought brilliantly to life by the award-winning narrator Robin Miles.
She does not want to remember, but she is here, and memory is gathering bones. She has come by foot and by bus to Addis Ababa, across terrain she has chosen to forget for nearly 40 years. She is 2 days early, but she will wait for him, seated on the ground in this corner of the train station, the metal box on her lap, her back pressed against the wall, rigid as a sentinel. She has put on the dress she does not wear every day. Her hair is neatly braided and sleek, and she has been careful to hide the long scar that puckers at the base of her neck and trails over her shoulder like a broken necklace.
Robin Miles narrating The Shadow King, written by my guest, Maza Mengiste. So, Maza, did you have anything to do with the selection of Robin Miles as the narrator?
My editor sent me Robin's samples, and I listened to some of the tracks, and I loved her voice. I loved the range, the emotion, and the coloring of her sentences and phrases. I was so excited to have her. I felt very honored.
And are you a fan of audiobooks yourself?
I listen to them when I can. I have to tell you, my very first encounter with them was on a road trip many years ago. I was taking a 10-day drive through the United States with a friend, and we had all these audiobooks, and I realized I was enjoying them so much, I wasn't always paying attention to the road when I was driving. So I have to listen to them at home.
You must be thrilled at being shortlisted for the Booker Prize. What does it mean to you as an author?
It means that there's a wider conversation happening about this war, about the people who suffered on both sides of the conflict. It means that the book gets more readers, and it also is an affirmation by a group of readers, the judges, that this book is worthy of greater attention. It feels like a gift in a year where so much has been grim to get this news. And it's also, for me, a deep and humbling honor, because I did not know over the course of writing this book, number one, whether I would finish, and number two, whether the risks I took would be something that would be accepted by readers. I wrote the book I wanted to write, and I was willing to fail if necessary. But the fact that it is been read and is being accepted like this is really a wonderful gift to have as I move into a new project.
And did you ever manage to meet your great-grandmother, and would she be proud?
You know, I met my great-grandmother, Red. She was very old when I saw her the last time. She was bedridden, and I was in a room with my relatives, and everyone is gathered around talking about her, reliving instances in her life. Nobody mentioned the war. Everybody mentioned how strong and stubborn she was, and she'd been known to like beat up men. I'm very short, and she was shorter than me. So I had those stories, and I would like to think that she would be proud of having this story out there, of having this part of her life spoken of, because it just wasn't counted as that important.
Well, Mazumin Gisti, I'm sure your great-grandmother would be immensely proud, and many congratulations on being shortlisted for this year's Booker Prize.
Thank you so much, Red. It's been a pleasure to talk to you.
Like all the books shortlisted for this and previous year's Booker Prizes, The Shadow King is available in a full range of accessible formats from the RNIB Library, thanks to the generous support of the Booker Foundation.
You're listening to Read On, RNIB Connect Radio's one-stop shop for book news, reviews and author interviews. And now, moving away from the Booker for a few minutes.
After a decade of editing and ghostwriting, MJ Ford stepped out of the shadows in 2018 with his debut thriller, Hold My Hand. A twisty police procedural set in Oxford, it has distinctly creepy undertones and introduced us to his protagonist, D.S. Josie Masters. With the third book in the series, Watch Over Me, out now, I wanted to find out more, so I invited MJ Ford onto the show. Michael, welcome.
Very pleased to be here.
Could you introduce us to Detective Sergeant Josie Masters?
I can, yes. I know her well. She is a detective with Thames Valley Police based in Oxford. I've been with her now for 3 years on and off. Obviously, I join her for sort of 3 months at a time while I'm writing a book and then discard her for the rest of the year. But I've charted her journey now from, in the first book, someone coming out of the back of a very difficult relationship in which her childlessness was the main thing that was affecting her personal life, and where I've just left her now after 3 years. She has a six-month-old baby. So in some ways, I've treated her quite well. However, in other ways, she has had a very hard existence. The cases I've thrust her into have risked her life on numerous occasions. So I have mixed feelings about Josie. I'm sure she does about me as well, because I'm the one pulling the strings of her life.
You really do like to put her through the mill. And certainly at the beginning of the first book, she'd done her absolute level best to leave Oxford, but she just seems to be drawn back into it deeper and deeper with every book.
Yes, that's right. I mean, she was born in Oxford and grew up there quite unhappily with her parents. So she's always wanted to get away. But as you say, she does keep being drawn back professionally and personally. In terms of my own journey, I keep being drawn back. I went to university there. And when it became time to set a series of books, it was a kind of obvious choice for me as well. I don't really have any painful memories of the place at all, though, like Josie does.
Apart from perhaps the odd hangover.
Oh, well, yeah, they tend to fade into the background though, don't they? And also, when you're 21, you don't really get bad hangovers like you do when you're 41.
What do you think it is about Oxford that means it has become the crime centre of the UK?
Yeah, well, of course it isn't. We should make that clear for the Oxford Tourist Board. I'm not sure how many murders they have in Oxford a year. I think it's probably two, whereas there's already been four or five times as many as that in my books. Oxford's a really interesting place. Obviously, it's got a very long history, but the way the kind of glamorous side of Oxford and the university, which is sort of the tourist spots, sit alongside what I suppose they call the town versus the gown, just makes it an interesting cross-section of people. You have the people riding around on bikes wearing mortarboards in that classic way, alongside other people just trying to live their lives, living in a normal, modern, cosmopolitan city. And, you know, it has all those problems that other cities have, the social problems of drugs and addiction, family dysfunction. So it's just an interesting melting pot to throw a murder investigation into.
And as you highlight in all the books, it also has very rural areas, cheek by jowl, with industrial areas and the beautiful university buildings as well.
Yeah, it does. And just from a publishing perspective, from a commercial publishing perspective, you quite often want to set a book somewhere which has some resonance in readers' minds anyway. You can obviously set crime stories anywhere. But yes, you're right. Oxford does have that large cross-section of both populace and geography.
And some very weird characters, certainly in your books. There is a real creepiness lingering in the background just on the corner of the reader's eye.
That's right. I mean, all of my crime books, the crimes all revolve around some sort of family relationship which has gone awry. As you say, normally in a quite a creepy way. Something has shattered what should be a normal relationship and driven a participant in that relationship to some form of psychopathy. The first book does have quite an out there ending, but I'm a firm believer that behind closed doors, all sorts of very odd things go on. Nothing is as strange as the life of other people, is it?
Absolutely. So at the beginning of the latest book, Josie is called to a North Oxfordshire house and surprised to find that she knows the body.
Yeah, all of the crime stories do in some way touch her personally, but this is the worst, I think, for her. It's not really a spoiler because it happens at the beginning of the book, but the character who's being killed is someone who we as readers over the previous two books have got quite close to him. He's a mentor, he's a retired police officer, he's a surrogate father figure in some ways to Josie herself. So yeah, she goes to the address with dread in her heart, and sadly her worst fears are realised. But of course that gives her even more impetus than normal to get to the bottom of who's the culprit.
And yes, again, avoiding spoilers, you rather like creating terrific characters and then bumping them off.
Yeah, I think before I was writing adult fiction, I was always writing children's fiction, in which the deaths are often a bit less gratuitous. But of course, I mean, it gives whoever the investigating character is this real drive to solve a crime. In children's fiction, in fact, that I hadn't realised I was doing this, but I do have a reputation for killing dogs. I'm a dog owner myself, don't get me wrong. I love animals like that. But yeah, there seem to be a lot of dogs or cats that get killed in my children's books as well.
Well, having done it once myself, in one of my own books, I did have a sense of regret after I killed the character off because I realised that writing her was one of the most fun parts of the book. Do you ever have those regrets yourself?
Not with dogs, because but yeah, with human characters. Killing Harry at the beginning of the latest book was really hard. And, you know, I don't mind saying that often while writing emotional scenes, I feel a misting of the eyes myself. But I sort of think I must be on the right track. If it's affecting me emotionally and I'm in charge like this, then hopefully it will have some similar effect upon the reader.
Now, you mention that you've written children's books and you've also been a ghostwriter in the past. Was that good training for writing your own series of books?
Do you know, I think it's quite a different discipline. I almost sort of think of it as like if you work as a builder or an architect and you have to go to someone's house and liaise with them on what they want to do with their extension. You might have an idea about a different direction you'd go in personally, but of course the client is the most important thing. Yeah, with ghostwriting, it's all about listening to what the other person wants and doing your best to kind of bring that to life. Whereas if you're in charge yourself and it's your own story, then you go whichever way what you wish.
I know I can't ask you who you've ghostwritten for, but was it TV personalities or sportsmen or a mix of everything?
Both, actually. I've done TV personalities. The other one was a sports person. Yeah. The processes would be fairly similar. One party was more involved than the other. And I don't really mind what the client wants in that regard, how involved they want to be. But no, it's great because normally they're, you know, really pleased with the finished result.
And it must have taught you the discipline of writing a target amount of words per day and treating it as a job.
Oh, yeah. I work in publishing and did so before I was a writer as well. And so I'm not unfamiliar with the world of deadlines. But yeah, I've worked on books which are, well, like these adult books are 90,000 words, but I've worked on books for children which are only 5,000 words. And it's always the case that the deadline in publishing is about 2 months less than you'd like it to be. But no, I'm always, it's quite unromantic, really. I'm always thinking about how many words I have to get down almost every time I sit down to write. There's very little time for shooting the breeze internally. It's all about getting the words down, because even obviously they're often terrible words the first time one writes them. But to have something at least in front of you to edit, I'm sure you'll know, is one of the most important things.
That first draft is always the most difficult, but once you've got it out of the way, it's something to polish up, hopefully, into the final draft.
Absolutely. And I don't neglect, as I mentioned here, my editors at the publisher, of course, because, you know, even when I think this is a fairly polished draft and submit it to them, there's always helpful guidance and constructive criticism coming back the other way. And the jump between what I first delivered to the publisher and the final script that we go with is normally fairly vast. Often books change quite a lot, even at that stage.
Now, of course, one of the other things that is built into the deadline now is the fact that the audiobook has to be recorded as well. And you're very lucky. You've got one of my favourite narrators of all time, Joan Walker, narrating your novels.
Yeah. I mean, it was a surprise to me, because when you're writing a book, you think about the physical book on a shelf. That's its manifestation in your head. But no, it was a complete surprise to me, the first adult novel I published, Hold My Hand, to find that there was an audiobook. And it was fantastic, because I said it to people who maybe don't have the capacity to read or get hold of books as easily. So yeah, it was brilliant. I haven't actually heard the latest one. I don't even know if it's been recorded yet.
It has, and it's in the RNIB library, and I'm on chapter 4 at the moment, so I certainly don't want any spoilers.
Joe Masters had attended dozens of dead bodies over the years, and the majority of deaths by far weren't suspicious at all. Road traffic collisions, freakish workplace accidents, squalid drug overdoses, elderly people who died alone and weren't discovered until putrefaction set in and the neighbours raised the alarm. Death struck randomly, oblivious to notions of justice or moral standing, ready to snuff the lives of the living and cast those left behind in darkness and misery. It was only when she became a mother that Jo realised quite how many threats lurked under her own roof. The clock read 10:04, which meant her visitor was late. However, the extra minutes did give her the opportunity to do a final sweep of the house and make sure that it was, to all intents and purposes, completely death-proof for a six-month-old baby. The magnetic strip that held the kitchen knives was way out of reach, so there was no danger there. The safety catches on the cupboards would keep any poisons safely stowed. All plug sockets had protective covers to prevent the insertion of conductive metals by curious fingers. Curtain cords were looped and fastened a metre above the floor, so there could be no accidental self-garrotting. Stairgates were braced so tightly against their wall mountings that even a rugby prop forward running at velocity would fail to dislodge them. Never mind that Theo could not yet crawl. Jo had vacuumed, swept, dusted, and anti-backsprayed to standards that would have impressed Vera Coyne, Thames Valley's forensic pathology supremo. Theo watched her with a mixture of smiles, squirms, and frowning curiosity as she dashed about like a dervish, trying to create the impression of parenting competence. He was probably wondering why all his stuffed animals were lined up on a shelf as if awaiting a drill sergeant's inspection, and why his mother had suddenly deemed to disinfect his favourite teething ring when she'd never bothered before.
Joan Walker, narrating Watch Over You, written by my guest, MJ Ford. Michael, are you a fan of audiobooks yourself?
I do listen to a lot of audiobooks. I tend to listen to non-fiction audiobooks, though. I find it harder to focus on fiction in audiobooks, and I don't really know why that is. I almost always read crime fiction as a physical book. I don't really use a Kindle very much at all. I don't know why that is. I mean, maybe I'm a slight traditionalist, but I really like crime books from all eras as well. Not even particularly modern ones, like Raymond Chandler and Agatha Christie. A lot of pulp fiction from the 70s and 80s.
And do you think they've influenced your writing, or do you draw your influences from other parts of fiction?
That's a really good question. I read fairly widely across genres. For instance, probably my favourite genre is actually sci-fi, or at least speculative fiction. So I think my style of writing is quite plot-based. I try to build quite a lot of suspense and dread. I have a weak spot for action sequences that probably need to be cut every now and then. And maybe it's because of my history writing children's fantasy and children's thrillers. I really draw influence from everywhere. I mean, I read quite a lot of literary fiction as well, which tends to be more sort of character-based, I suppose.
I definitely get a bit of a sense of the Daphne du Maurier's or the Brontes.
Yeah, well, some of the children's fiction I've written is in the mold of a sort of Victorian ghost story. And certainly I like those worlds of suspense and dread where you kind of know something not quite right is happening and something not quite in your everyday sphere of knowledge. For instance, in Hold My Hand, you'll probably know that the ending becomes almost macabre, sinister. And certainly some of the crime books that I've read that have influenced that have been those of Mo Haider, who writes a series of books in which sometimes you're not even sure if the book is going to veer into the supernatural. So yeah, I do like that sort of thing.
Yes, that sense that the gargoyle on the top of the Oxford College might just swoop down on you.
Yeah, exactly.
So are you going to give Josie a rest for 6 months or allow her to bring up her baby, or have you got something horrible in store for her already?
Yeah, well, I'm partly giving her a rest because I'm working on something slightly different at the moment. I feel she deserves one. She should have a chance to at least bring up this new child without being interfered with for a while. But I don't think I can let her rest forever. No, I think we'll have to go back. You know, having a baby does have some constraints on how a book can be plotted. I spoke to some police officers about the realities of returning from maternity leave to the police force, and it's not particularly a pretty picture in many ways. There's some active duty elements that you can't get involved with anymore. So I think what I might do is I might leave her for a couple of years, actually, let this toddler at least get a bit older, slightly more independent, let her get her life back on more of an even keel before I jump in again and mess things up.
Well, I've got to get back to the crime scene with Josie and try and work out what happened to Harry. But I hope you'll come back at the end of the show to share the books of your life. And in the meantime, MJ Ford, thank you for being a guest on Read On.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Watch Over You by MJ Ford joins the first two books in the DS Josie Masters series in the R&IB Talking Books Library.
A gift in your will is a really special way to continue supporting R&IB. Large or small, all gifts can have a huge impact on our services, as our work is vital and our services are needed more than ever. Over a third of the work we do is funded by the generosity of supporters who leave a gift in their will to R&IB. If you leave a legacy, you will make a significant difference to the lives of blind and partially sighted people, so their future is full of opportunity. Creating a will offers you the chance to make sure the people and causes you care about most are supported for years to come. We've made it easier for you to write or update your will with our free, accessible and simple will writing services. To find out more, please call 0303 123 9999 or go to rnib.org.uk/legacy.
You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB. And now, let's return to the Booker Prize and the last of our six interviews with its shortlisted authors this year.
4 years ago, Brandon Taylor abandoned his postgraduate studies in biochemistry to focus on creative writing. His debut novel, Real Life, has been published to great acclaim and been shortlisted for this year's Booker Prize. In it, he puts loneliness, desire, and finding a meaning to life under the microscope, as he told me when he joined me from his home in Iowa City. Brandon Taylor, welcome to Read On.
Thank you for having me.
For anyone who hasn't yet picked up Real Life, could you give us a brief synopsis?
Sure. Real Life is a novel about a young man, Wallace, who is Black and gay, and he's from the American South, and he's currently studying biochemistry at a Midwestern university. And the novel opens on one of those typical Fridays in grad school when you find out your experiment that you've been working on all summer has been ruined. And Wallace chooses to go to the lake with his friends for the first time in many years, and it sets into motion a series of confrontations and collisions among his friends and in his personal and professional life as he reckons with what is a real life and what does he want from the life he's chosen.
And he's very much a young man who finds solace in work or study, but when that's disrupted, it gives him a bit of an existential crisis.
Yes, I think Wallace, like many people of our generation, we over-identify with our work because we've had to make a series of concessions to winnow our lives down to survive our circumstances. And when the thing that you've identified as your way of being and the only way you have of understanding yourself and your value to the world is threatened, it does send you spiraling out into, what even am I outside of this very narrow context of biomedical research? What am I without my work? And I think it's when his research is threatened that he realizes that that is actually what he's done, is like he's winnowed his life down to such small essentials, basically. And he's like, oh, I have given up every other thing in my life, and the only thing I have is this work. This is all I have, and now it's ruined, and who even am I?
There's very much a sense that he doesn't feel he's living up to his own expectations, but overarching all of this are the expectations or the inbuilt prejudices of the university that he's at. It's a liberal white campus, which would be mortified to think that it is racist, but by its own belief in its utopian liberal ideals, it can't see that a lot of what it does undercut Wallace's self-belief.
Yes. And I think that this is true of many things in the world, is that people believe that they are good. And very often they are good, but they're also capable of being complicit in these larger social evils without realizing it. And it's an uncomfortable realization to realize that you are complicit in the oppression of people that you otherwise do think of as your equals and people that you do love and want to protect. You know, the ways that we're always kind of socially maiming each other. And you might feel that someone's foot is on your neck, but what I think is ultimately true is that your foot is often on someone else's. And so, yeah, like Wallace struggles with his own sense of who am I, where am I going? But you're totally right about the larger set of confusions for him being this, you know, what happens in a progressive liberal town when you can feel the pressures of these oppressive hierarchies such as racism, classism, homophobia, sexism, etc. When you can feel it, but they don't realize they're doing it to you. They don't realize they're exerting this weird pressure upon you. And what happens when you have that awareness and the people oppressing you do not? And how do you begin to negotiate your relationships to them and to the place where you're residing? So, yeah, I mean, part of the novel is a very personal novel about existential crisis of people in their mid to late 20s. But I think it's also a novel about the social anxieties around these oppressive structures in our society.
Amongst the white cohort, who are his friends, there's an almost morbid obsession with wearing suffering as badges of pride. They're looking for problems and reasons to feel oppressed or damaged. There's a toe-curling moment when Wallace finally does admit that his father has passed away, and his white friends want to take ownership of that so that they can emote his grief, and he loses something by that.
One of the things I wanted to explore in the book is this idea that there are these social scripts that we're supposed to adhere to in moments of bereavement or moments of joy or this or that. And what happens when you call those things out as false? When Wallace loses his dad, he has all these conflicted and confusing feelings about that loss because his relationship to his father is really complicated. But when he tells other people about it, that complexity goes out of it because his friends immediately rush in to force him to adhere to the script. And he just does not But first he accepts it. He's like, okay, this is what people do. They want you to act a certain way and behave a certain way when you're quote unquote grieving. But then he begins to sort of chafe under the pressure of that. And he's like, why are we adhering to these scripts? Like, why am I giving you the authority to dictate what my feelings are? Why can't I just stand in the complexity and the ambiguity of this relationship? And I think what he finds is that other people are very uncomfortable with the unscripted, with the extemporaneous expression of grief or emotion. What makes them comfortable is when things fall within a set of parameters that they understand. And I think we're doing it to each other all the time in a million different ways. And in almost every moment, we socially police each other's behaviors and reactions, because if we just let the feeling be big and be complicated and be messy, we don't know how to respond in that moment. And that makes us feel less equipped and less supportive because we don't have the perfect rejoinder to someone's unalloyed grief.
And yet the terrible irony of this is that it's a university campus. You're meant to be asking questions. You're meant to be exploring. And they're almost doing the opposite. Was that part of the reason for your choosing a campus as the locale of the book?
Maybe so. I think that I chose a campus because I know enough about yet to fill an entire book with. I was like, I've spent my entire life on campuses. You know, I've been going to school my whole life. If there's anything I know the weird mores of academia. And so that was the larger motivating force for picking a campus. But yes, I love the idea that all the sort of subtle ironies that take place on a college campus where people are, you're right, meant to be trying to open up their minds and have new experiences and question the systems of our society. And often that happens in the classroom. Like often people are having these really wonderful conversations about politics and religion and geopolitics, etc. But in our person-to-person interactions, often that is not the case. When it comes to the interpersonal, we often become no different from people in the 1950s, the sort of very strict social codes and social mores. And something that my friends and I talk a lot about is how the terms change, but the overall geometry stays basically the same.
And you yourself were studying biochemistry, like Wallace, and decided to quit your PhD and pursue creative writing. Was that an easy decision for you?
No, it was one of the most difficult decisions of my life. I will say that I had written Real Life and I'd written another book of stories before I made the decision to leave, just almost to prove to myself that I could do science and write at the same time. And so that I wasn't making the decision out of duress to want to go write a book. I really wanted to try to do both at the same time and to prove to myself that I was capable of doing it. But when it came down to it, my thesis advisor told me that if I were to stay in science, she would expect me to put aside my writing for the amount of time it would take to finish my dissertation, which didn't seem like an unreasonable ask. But when I thought about it, I realized that my writing was really starting to take off and I didn't know that I could set it aside in order to really dedicate myself to science. When I thought about it, I felt I could live without science, as difficult and painful as that was, but I couldn't live without writing. I tried and it had made me miserable and unhappy. And so I had quite a literal choice to make. And what I found was that I was just not up to it. I just couldn't fathom putting aside my writing and focusing exclusively on science. I just could not do that. So I made the choice to leave. But I had applied to the Iowa Writers' Workshop earlier that year because I thought my science wasn't going well and I felt like I needed a backup plan. So I applied and never thought I would get in. And by the time I got the acceptance to the Writers' Workshop, my science was going beautifully. And the Writers' Workshop definitely was like a real concrete choice that I had to make.
Many thousands of people and the Booker judges clearly think that you made the right decision. However, I believe that Real Life had to be rescued from the bin by one of your friends.
It did. So after I decided that I was going to be a writer, I sent the book out to a few agents who had represented books I really loved, and they all got back to me with kind but very clear rejections. And I thought, oh, this is a terrible decision that I have made. My writing isn't worth it. So I deleted Real Life and my short story collection from my computer. And then I took the hard copies I had and put them literally into the trash can. And my roommate at the time, who's one of my dear, dear friends, he said, "What are you doing?" And I said, "Well, I'm not a good writer. I'm just going to focus on science because these agents clearly don't want me. If I were a good writer, they would want me." And he told me that I was out of my mind, and he took them out of the trash. And he said, "When you deserve these, you can have them back." And he took both of the manuscripts to his office on campus and locked them in and didn't let me have them back until I come to my senses. You know, sometimes I think that your friends believe in you even when you don't believe in yourself. And that's one of the great treasures of a good friendship, is that they believe in you even when you are getting buffeted around by the world. Your friends are there to tell you who you are and why you do what you do. He was one of my guardian angels.
It was a cool evening in late summer when Wallace, his father dead for several weeks, decided that he would meet his friends at the pier after all. The lake was dimpled with white waves. People coveted these last blustery days of summer before the weather turned cold and mercurial. The air was heavy with their good times as the white people scattered across the tiered patios, pried their mouths apart, and beamed their laughter into each other's faces. Overhead, gulls drifted easy as anything. Wallace stood on an upper platform looking down into the scrum, trying to find his particular group of white people, thinking also that it was still possible to turn back, that he could go home and get on with his evening. It had been a couple of years since he had gone to the lake with his friends, a period of time that embarrassed him because it seemed to demand an excuse, and he did not have one. It might have had something to do with the crowds, the insistence of other people's bodies, the way the birds circled overhead, then dive-bombed the tables to grab food or root around at their feet, as though even they were socializing. Threats from every corner. There was also the matter of the noise, the desperate braying of everyone talking over everyone else, the bad music, the children and dogs, the radios from the frats down the lakeshore, the car stereos in the streets, the shouting mass of hundreds of lives disagreeing. The noise demanded vague and strange things from Wallace.
Kevin R. Free, narrating Real Life, written by my guest, Brandon Taylor. Brandon, I believe you've got a very personal reason for being delighted that Real Life is available as an audiobook to blind and partially sighted readers.
Yeah, my dad has been legally blind my entire life, and he has glaucoma and cataracts. And so I've often thought about people who are visually impaired. And yeah, so it means a lot to me, in fact.
And presumably you're delighted with Kevin R. Free's narration of the book.
I love it. I listened to it from start to finish and marveled that he pulls nuances out of the book that were things that I imagined when I was writing, but never expressed to anyone. And he found almost every single one of them, all the little beats of humor. He knew exactly where I wanted to be funny, or where I wanted a line that was written as funny to come off as kind of melancholy or sad. And he just found his way into the text in a way that was just really incredible. And yeah, I mean, he did a beautiful job on it.
You weren't tempted to narrate the book yourself, though?
Oh, absolutely not. Absolutely not. I enjoy giving readings. I enjoy reading my work aloud, but I feel that audiobook narration is an art, and I take it really seriously. And so I'm very much aware of my own limitations as a performer and a reader. And the idea of trying to do all those different voices just gives me anxiety on a level that is just beyond. Yeah, so no, I had no illusions about wanting to narrate that audiobook.
Something else you've said that rather puzzled me was that writing a novel ruins your life in very specific ways. What do you mean by that?
To write this novel, I had to get inside of it, and I lived that novel for the entire duration I was working on it. So I would wake up, I would go to lab, I would work in lab for 15 hours a day, and during my breaks I would only write this novel, and I would only think about this novel. I had no social life. There were no idle moments in my life. The novel really took up all of the space that was available in my mind and in my life that wasn't already taken up by being a doctoral student and working in a lab. And so writing a novel required for me a level of obsession and intense immersion that just ruined my life. I didn't eat well. I didn't sleep well. I saw my friends maybe once or twice during the whole duration of it. You know, when people would try to talk to me, I would look at them with this like far away look and just be like, I don't know what you're talking about. I don't know what's happening in the world. I don't know. It was like having a fever for weeks and weeks and weeks. And when it finally broke, looking back at that time and having no recollection of what you had done, it was really intense. And there's no way that that kind of intense focus and preoccupation doesn't deform your life in some ways. At least that was the case for me. I have relationships that have still not recovered from the 5 weeks I spent on Real Life.
So can we expect more short stories from you, or do you think you will reinfect yourself and go back into self-isolation and write another novel?
Well, so my next book is a collection of short stories, but I have since sold to my US publisher 2 more novels. So I have written more novels in the time since writing Real Life. And they did not ruin my life in quite the same ways that writing that first one did, but they did take a great deal of focus and dedication and intense absorption. And yet again, I have relationships that are never going to be the same.
Well, I hope that you'll come back onto the show to discuss the next 2 novels, and in the meantime, that your relationships recover. Many congratulations on being shortlisted for the Booker Prize. Brandon Taylor, thank you so much for coming onto the show.
Thank you for having me.
Like all the books on this and previous year's Booker shortlists, Real Life is available in a full range of accessible formats from the RNIB Library, thanks to the generous support of the Booker Foundation.
Alas, that's all we've got time for today. But Read On will be back at the same time next week and is always available to download as a podcast. Just search your favourite provider for Read On, the audiobook show. Thanks again to all my guests and, of course, to you for listening. Farewell until next week, and don't forget to read on.